hate Saturday night. The worst night of the week. Confession night. Soon they'll be flooding in, the young and the old, the fit and the weak, the rich and the poor, into the laundromat of the Catholic Church, the post-tub of the Catholic soul, the confessional box. And I, playing the part of the church's trusty old bag lady, am waiting to unburden them of their filthy loads. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. They pour in, every one of them pleased that they haven't been hit by a double-decker bus or struck by lightning on the way here while steeped in mortal sin. Not in a state of grace, you see. Devil bait. Oh, yes. A guarantee of a quick trip to hell, and deservedly so, if they die on the way here, that is. But no, if they make it to the confessional, they've got away with it again. The gamble's paid off. They've savored sin and haven't had to pay a proper price. And the proper price? Well, a couple of centuries baking in purgatory would soon sort out some of my less salubrious parishioners. They deserve to feel the wrath of God, distributed on his behalf by me, their parish priest. But no way, Jose, as they say, not these days, namby-pamby, treat them with kid gloves is the order of the day. Vatican II still has a lot to answer for. They can come and dump their sins on me, their parish priest, every Saturday, and let me, with a wave of my hand and a few words I've spoken so many times I've lost track of what they mean, send them on their way with souls pristine and pure. All of them ready to get underway, sinning again with the merest minuscule penance to perform, that is all I'm allowed to bestow in these enlightened days. Saturday night, eh? Used to love it. But times change. People have changed. The world's changed. When did you last see a stranger smile? When did you last hear someone whistling as they walked? You didn't. Whistling has died. Nothing must interfere with our hearing. Attuned, jungle animal fashion for the scream in the distance, the footfall at our back, and that's during the day. As night falls, terror holds sway, particularly for we old people. Every value has changed, and it hasn't changed for the better. Being old had a value in the old days. Being a priest had a value in the Catholic community. Schoolboys doffed their caps, men saluted. Ladies did a strange sort of half-curtsy to show their respect. Being an old priest was a serious bonus. You were loved, respected, and looked up to. All gone. Now, age and being a priest simply makes you an easy target. I even find myself looking over my shoulder as I deadhead the roses in the presbytery garden. Who would think you could be mugged while gardening and wearing a clerical collar and a purple waistcoat? But you could. I could. So I keep my eye out. Bad days. But you can't go back. Wave a magic wand and have the old days back. People say it would be awful in any case. But I'd have it back. Like a flash. I'd swap the inside loo with its fitted carpet and soft pink toilet paper, bought because of a playful puppy on telly, like a flash. Exchange it for a lean-to at the bottom of the backyard with cut-up squares of the News of the World hanging on a nail halfway up the wall, like a flash. Providing I can have the old values returned, providing people can whistle again, providing they treat an old priest with respect. But you can't go back. You can't unchange what has changed in the world. You can't unchange what has changed inside your heart. I find that slowly all my gestures of good manners and simple priestly courtesies are being discarded. Sign of the times. Apart from opening doors for ladies, that is. A courtly gesture I've never got out of since childhood. Mummy always insisted on it, along with offering my seat to the elderly on buses, and when walking along the street with a woman walking on the outside so my sword arm was always free. Also, of course, in case wild horses came careering round the corner, at which point I could, according to Mummy, protect the lady by jumping in front of her, letting the horses trample me to death in her place. That's what I used to do for ladies. Give up my seat, walk on the outside, open doors. Just like Mummy said I must. Simple courtesies. So much ill manners in the world now, so many ill-mannered people. But I have never heard in confession in the last 20 years one person say, "Forgive me, Father, but I was rude, surly, unhelpful, behaved like an ignorant lout," or whatever. And I think they should confess. For surely it is just as much a sin to help increase the level of misery in the world as it is to swear. But nobody ever does. Simple good manners, it would seem, have gone forever. In the old days, quite often, they would confess. A boy might say, "I was rude to a fat old lady, Father. I pushed past her without saying sorry. He shouted, 'Stop taking up all the pavement, fatty.'" And as part of his penance, if he knew the woman, he would have to find her and apologize. And he did, and felt better for it, at peace with himself for having made amends. For if it hadn't troubled him, he wouldn't have told me in the first place. And the woman, too, would have been pleased and also felt a little better, and perhaps a little thinner because of it. You see, that's a good example of why confession in the old days was simply a pleasure to me. No, I lie. It was much more than simply a pleasure. It was my delight. I made no secret of the fact I loved it, confession, no secret at all. My fellow priest would have known it was a Saturday without even a glance at the date in the Racing Herald. I was always aglow, like a frisky young puppy that spotted his master carrying the lead ready for walkies. Aglow, in a perfect dither of excitement from dawn till the time to make myself available to give the gift of that golden sacrament to the innocent, sinning masses of those far-gone days. To send them forth, after a suitable penance, a proper 5 rosaries plus the Stations of the Cross on your knees penance, with their souls deservedly shining beacon bright, the light of their newly returned purity cutting through the darkness of surrounding sin, like an usherette's torch at Saturday morning pictures, which I never went to, but heard about quite often in confession, as the Saturday morning pictures were a bit of a hotbed for sinning in those days. Probably still are. But of course I didn't mind them sinning when they had to pay a proper price by praying a proper penance. If they had misbehaved in the back row of the flea pit, fair enough, but I had them on their knees for hours to compensate for all the fun, and they didn't begrudge it. It was a fair exchange, you see. If you have a good sin and enjoy yourself while doing it, only right you should suffer a bit. And they knew it and accepted it. There was one wicked young boy who started slowly in the sexual sinning stakes. Took him forever before he came and knelt in the confessional and said, "Forgive me, Father, I did it for the first time last night. I resisted the temptation to say, 'Thank goodness we've got that out of the way,' and gave him a big penance to show there was a price to pay. And then, before you could say, 'Bob's your uncle,' within a month he was going at it like a rabbit. More girls per week than I could believe possible. He was making Casanova look like a slouch. I started to think he might be making it up. I finally had to say to him, 'How are you managing to meet so many girls?' And then he confessed he'd been making notes of the girls who came to my confession late and stayed a long time in the box, and asking them out for a date on the expectation that they were very game, which, of course, on the whole, they were. I was furious. I gave him a penance that must have kept him on his knees for the rest of the night and told him not to do it again. I also told the girls to come to confession at whatever time they chose from that day forward. It really was a truly strange moment all those years ago. It gave me pause, a moment, to think of the simple circuitry of sin. The boy was sinning more successfully because I was trying to help young girls who were in danger of falling by the wayside. As to the girls, after confessing to me, they were then going off sinning with the young boy because he had managed to target them as bad girls. How much of the blame for this increase in sinning must I bear? I did think about it a great deal. At the time, I felt quite guilty. No, very guilty. It's not just sin I hear in here. It's life. And family life, one side of it, that is, the bad side. Nobody ever arrives saying the sun is shining, everything in the garden is lovely, and I'm on top of the world, Father. No, never the good, always the bad, never enough of love and laughter and happy days and joy, much too much of the rich black scene that is being endlessly turned and churned and sniffed at and savoured in the deep black, dirty, disgusting darkness of a million minds, much too much of the cesspit side of this wicked world in which we live. I've heard too much. I even heard of a killing once. Yes, a killing. Sitting in the box, taking confession, and there it was, the biggie, a murderer, on the other side of the gauze, just feet away from me. That shook me badly. I can't really talk about it, not for the moment. But I must finally talk about it. I must, or maybe later. We'll see. I don't know at what exact point I went from loving the sacrament of confession to hating it, but once it had gone off as a pleasure, it very quickly became a pain. I've thought about it a lot, particularly since they sent me to this godforsaken parish where I know nobody, where I have to learn from scratch who the penitents are behind the gauze. I knew them all in the parish where I spent the bulk of my working life many times before they even spoke. A cleared throat, a smell of perfume, a rheumatic sigh as they knelt. In many cases, I could have made their confessions for them. I swore at the wife, father, kicked the cat, and then went off and had a pint or two too many, which with that particular penitent's drinking habits would no doubt be considered the understatement of the century. According to his wife, that is, as she knelt in the box and told her side of the story, the man is a drunken sot, father, and deserves to hang in the fire of hell for a few centuries to dry out. She was probably right. But then she shouldn't have been doing what she was doing with the milkman on a daily basis, just to make her husband secretly pay. A double blow to the deceived, the milkman was a Protestant. If he'd been a Catholic, he'd have had to confess to me, and I'd have soon put an end to his shenanigans. But no, no such luck. Still, it was a useful confession in that it did at least explain why the milk was always late arriving at the presbytery at that time. She was right. Her husband was a drunken sot. He never changed in all the years I knew him. Neither did she. She hated him and revenged him to the end. But they were good Catholics and never separated, which was a blessing of sorts, so my governor, the Pope, would have us believe. Speaking personally, I'm not really that sure any more. Why live in misery for a lifetime when you can get divorced and go to confession the week after and have the sin cleansed for the price of 2 Hail Marys and 1 Our Father? Still, can't tell my parishioners that. Wouldn't be right. Over the years, I've come to realize that we Catholics are very ordered in our pleasures and our perversities, quite conservative in a way. Once we've established our pattern, we are, to be honest, a little dull in our sinning. It became so obvious that repetition was the order of the day that I even thought at one time I'd give the usual run-of-the-mill sins numbers so they could confess them more quickly. Bless me, Father, in the last 2 weeks I've done number 8 6 times, number 3 twice, and I've lost track of how many times I did number 1, but I am bearing in mind your warning about possibly going blind. And then I thought, no, I'd probably start to feel like a waiter in a Chinese restaurant, occasionally driven to making suggestions. Ah, try number 7. Everyone says it's very good, very juicy. It wouldn't be right. But I have discovered that once you've got used to your own pattern of sinning, established your own rhythm of sin, it's very hard to change, slip in a new one. Once a man is into dressing up in high-heeled shoes and long frocks, he's probably there for life. Can't suddenly go over to Macintoshes and Wellington boots and flashing in the waterworks. When it comes to sin, it turns out we are creatures of habit, and we all sin. We do all sin, especially us Catholics. In our system, it's very hard not to sin. It's ever so easy to sin. A boy glances at a girl, thinks a thought, it's done. He's sinned, and he's instantly booked. The mind police are on constant patrol, and we Catholics are our own traffic wardens, issuing the tickets and paying the due fine on Saturday in confession. But there is a problem, a basic weakness in the system. Sin is only sin when you're told it's sin. But who started defining sin in the first place? The cannibals in the jungle telling their kids to eat the victim's eyeballs up and not leave them on the side of their plate because it would make their hair curly weren't sinning. That is what they did. They killed people and they ate them, not a sin. Until the missionaries arrived, there was no one to tell them munching eyeballs was sin, so it wasn't. So, who defines sin for us Catholics? Was Jesus there at the outset saying, this silliness is a venial sin, it's worth 2 weeks in purgatory, and this biggie is a mortal sin, and you burn in hell forever? No. He preached love. Ask and it shall be given to you. He preached hope. Seek and you shall find. He preached heaven for all who were simply good. Knock and the door will open. And we've got to bear in mind he wasn't even a Catholic. Don't tell anyone I mentioned it, but he wasn't. Jesus was, dare I say it, ever so slightly Jewish. And he definitely wasn't responsible for the trappings, the gold rings for kissing, the chasubles, the ermine, the golden vestments, the chalices, palaces, churches, chapels, the trappings, no, definitely not his doing. Open-toed sandals, a seamless coat, a staff, and he was ready to hit the road. He made St. Francis of Assisi look overdressed, but he did have a gift, a God-given gift. Jesus understood people. He forgave people. He loved people. I can't stand people anymore. It's the truth. People are awful. Each day I see it confirmed. We live in a graceless world. Hail Mary, full of grace. How I love that line in that most precious prayer to the Virgin. How I love that word, grace. And where is it now? Dumped in the lexical dustbin along with gay and other such beautiful words that have either lost their original meaning or changed their meaning beyond recognition. I watch out for grace in a person as a train spotter watches out for a particularly precious number, hopeful of one day finding it again. Once, a few months ago, I thought I saw it in the street, a young wisp of a girl, no more than a child, a gossamer frail young creature, the Virgin personified. A beautiful butterfly who had landed in a dark doorway of an evil and ugly city, having lost the power to fly, to flee, to rise above the debris. An angelic face, potentially full of grace. So I stopped and I spoke to her gently and kindly, so as not to startle her or frighten her away. I said if she liked, I would take her to the presbytery, let her use the bath, fresh, warm towels available to her, and then give her a good meal and maybe find a few pounds so she could get a room for the night. She said, "Push off, you lecherous old git." What's the opposite of grace? Yes, disgrace. She was a disgrace. So I ceased my senseless search for that which I feel will never be found again in my lifetime. Grace. People are simply too awful for it to exist in this harsh world. My fellow priests here, they are equally awful. They have nothing to do with me. I've been dumped here without a by your leave, a relic from a different age, put here to rot. But why am I being punished? Why have I been dragged away from those I know and love and trust to be thrust among strangers? Because I've grown old, rooted in my ways, unable to accept change, drowning in a sea of sin I no longer have the wit to comprehend, unable to understand the changes that come all too rapidly. Forgive me, Father, but I took two E's last weekend and went surfing on the web, hacking into private property. What's an E? What's a web? What's hacking? Private property, I understand, but surfing for it? Surfing sounds healthy enough, quite bracing, in fact. Is it a good thing or bad? He's confessing it, so it must be bad, but why? And what's the appropriate penance? I am the Roman Catholic equivalent of the Millennium Bug. I am a 2KY disaster, and I had to be eradicated, eviscerated, debugged, so the year 2000 can dawn without being affected by the malignant diseases I carry. And the diseases? Yesterday's memories, yesterday's values, yesterday's simple sweet dreams turn sour, so I'm shipped here. God knows what they've done here to deserve having an old curmudgeon like me dropped in their midst. But whatever the reason, they now have me. I am their penance, and they are making me pay. They laugh at me behind my back, make jokes about my likeness to the mad old priest in Father Ted. Me, like Father Jack, it's absurd. I never said feck in my life. Mummy would never have allowed it. And yes, I like a drink or two, or three, maybe four. What good priest doesn't? If it wasn't for liberal doses of whiskey, the Catholic priesthood would probably fall apart. I agree, it's not for nothing that Catholic is only a couple of letters adrift from being an anagram of alcoholic. But I don't drink that much. Only enough to drown out their cruel laughter. Yes, they laugh at me behind my back. Conversation stops when I come into supper, and the meal continues in silence, half a smirk on their lips until I leave the room. And then I hear the conversation erupt behind the closing door. And I hate silence. If I'd wanted silence, I'd have become a Trappist monk. I wanted to be a priest. Wanted to stand high on the altar, my back to the crowd, and be respected, looked up to, almost adored by the poor people of that parish, as I performed with panache and piety the daily miracle before their very eyes. Bread into his body, wine into his blood before their very eyes. And then the sheer thrill of taking the freshly blessed, transubstantiated host into my mouth. A miracle happened every time. I was at one with God through his Son, Jesus Christ. Then to feel the host melt and fill my whole being with a golden glow from top to toe, the supreme, irreplaceable pleasure of the priesthood. A daily miracle. And that exquisite, climactic, spiritual moment, I knew that I was at one with 1 billion believers worldwide, part of the largest family in the world that had Mary as our mother, Jesus as our brother, and God benignly watching over us, caring and keeping us safe. They won't let me say Mass anymore. Here, in this parish, they won't let me say Mass. There were one or two moments of forgetfulness, a bell rung out of place, a fumbling at the missal, a dropped Eucharist, which I agree was potentially sacrilege, but not intentional. So it doesn't really count. And I'm off the roster, I'm off the Mass roster. I said I'd even do the ghost shift, the 6:30 Mass on a Sunday morning, but they said, no, you've earned a lie-in. I don't want to lie in. If I'd wanted to lie in on a Sunday morning, I'd have become a rabbi. I don't want to lie in, I want to serve. I want to try to recapture the moment when I actually thought something was happening. High on that altar, my back to that congregation, that the whole business wasn't just a sham, that the host and wine really did transmogrify into the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ, even at 6:30 on a Sunday morning. I wanted to believe again. I wanted to believe. I want to believe. What's that? Oh, no. No, it's too early. It's much too early. Too much to think about. Can't start yet. Switch off the light before he gets here. Is it him again? No. Footsteps. Too light to be him, thank God. Oh, good. He's gone into a pew. Sat down. Waiting my arrival. Soon be others, of course. No doubt chock-a-block with sin. If only they knew what I thought of them. If only they knew. I'd love to talk to somebody about it. It can't be right to feel this way about my parishioners. But there's nobody. Nobody. No one to talk to. That's my problem. No one to talk to. Especially not the other priests. No, not them. No one who could possibly understand. Understand how alone I am. Nobody could begin to comprehend the weight of the loneliness I feel, except perhaps someone who was traumatically deaf. They'd understand, all right, the eternal silence. They'd understand. Everybody who held a place in my life has gone. Dead. There's nobody. All gone. All dead. All dead and gone. Father Hagen went first. Then Father Dean, not long after. 40-a-day men, each of them, so you don't have to be a genius to guess what they died of. Then my 3 brothers and 3 sisters went down like 9 pins, even though there were only 6 of them. Like clockwork, 1 a year for 6 years. We had been the perfect Catholic family. 3 nuns, 3 priests, and a bookie. But the big reaper put a stop to that. 1 a year down the drain until all that was left was me. Mummy died soon after Jerome, the last one died, the youngest. Her heart was broken. It had been a burden to lose the others, but manageable. He was, I believe, the light of her life. Before she took to her deathbed, she rang me, her voice shaking with anger, and said, "And you say there is a God? You must be joking." Then she slammed the phone down on me without waiting for a reply. Soon after she died, without saying another word to me. Father blamed me, of course. I was the eldest, you see, the firstborn. Unfair that I should have survived them all. As eldest, he had wanted me to take the family business over, bookmaking. Not the youngest, who finally had to. Father said, if I'd been a bookie, things would have been different. Becoming a priest had changed the odds in some way and made everybody die. A bit like Job, I was cursed. I remember how he had begged me to take the business over and not become a priest, but Mummy had said I was made for greater things. God would call me. The parish priest, Father Peter, had told her it was God's wish that I be a priest. Father Peter, who for years had come to visit, his sole intention apparently to make my father cross, because she gave weight and time and consideration to his opinion and none to my father's. She laughed at Father Peter's little jokes and scowled at my father because he didn't. So Mummy and her parish priest decided I would be a priest. No discussion. They were simply fulfilling God's will, and given time and push and sulks and tantrums, they were finally proved right. Helped by Father Peter, God did call me, and like Neil Armstrong on the moon, my vocation finally landed. One small step for mankind. I went into the seminary, studied for more years than I care to think about, and finally took my vows and became a priest. And Mummy and Father Peter drank too much at my ordination, sang loudly and untunefully, for he's a jolly good fellow, and made my father angry. And for the first time at my ordination, I caught sight of Father Peter looking at my mother and laughing in a certain way. And as I looked, I was struck with horror. Absolute, mind-stunning horror. I was looking at my own reflection. He was my spitting image. I was his spitting image. Two peas out of the same pod. It lasted only a split second. He shifted and the likeness had gone. But I had seen it. And I knew. I was his son. I was the priest's son. The father was my father. This man who through all my years in the seminary had been my father confessor. This man who had comforted me when I spoke of my fears of not being able to keep hold of the vow of chastity I'd taken, not being able to control my all too eager young flesh. Be patient, he said. When lust turns to rust, celibacy is a must. And I took comfort from his words. This man who I had shared my every thought with, good and bad, had known my mother, biblically. Perhaps only the once, I hope, but even if it was only the once, it was once too many. He was a priest, and priests take vows, and the vows must be kept. All this, I thought, within a millisecond of realizing the awful truth. I was this man's child. Then I saw my father had seen it also, and he wasn't shocked. Cuckolded by his parish priest and not shocked. Then I realized he obviously knew, but didn't want to upset Mummy by letting her know he knew, and that he had come to terms with it. We secretly shared a vow of silence. I never spoke of it with anyone, not with Father Peter, my mother, my father, my brothers, my sisters, my fellow priests, no one. It was my thorn, a thorn that pricked whenever I saw them until they had all died, and then it pricked no more. For by then I had seen and heard so much of life that nothing could surprise me. A priest cuckolding a member of his congregation, small beer in the catalogue of everyday, ordinary and extraordinary sin that I've heard over the years, plus, of course, the awful growing realization that I now live my life in a soiled profession. Bishops bearing bastards, priestly brutality and buggery of young people in their care being revealed every day worldwide, greasy palms confirmed at the very top, the Vatican Bank, an impossible suicide staged to close the books on the whole sordid affair, leading to a body found hanging under Blackfriars Bridge, a suitable Calvary for Calvi, masons and factions within the papacy no doubt in close embrace for a job well done. Yes, a soiled profession, a shamefully soiled profession. And no pus tub in the world big enough to scrub it clean. People used to look up to us priests, now they look at us with a sideways glance, and who can blame them? We priests were a force for good within our Catholic communities. We were the singular, magic, golden unicorn who brought news of God's precious gift of belief to a doubting world. Now we have been dehorned and debased by events beyond our control until we, golden unicorns, are eunuchs to a man. Every parish in the land diminished. I was proud to be a priest, proud to be Catholic, proud. Now I'm shamed. I am shamed. And I had my shame confirmed the night a murderer came to call. He came into the church late. I heard his going down the side aisle. I was taking a young girl's confession, nothing very special, sensual dreams about pop stars causing the bulk of her problems. Then I heard him arrive. Funny that, how you can be doing one thing and yet be equally aware of another. There was something about his walk. He was walking heavy-footed as if to test the echo of the church, like a child might shout boo into a tunnel to hear it reverberate. When he finally sat in the pew outside the box, I heard him do so quite distinctly as I heard the man who is out there now. I advised the girl to start listening to Cliff Richard's albums, as he was a nice boy and wouldn't inflame her so disgracefully, gave her a large penance, and she left. I waited, but the man didn't come in. He stayed sitting in the pew. I waited for what seemed like an age, but still, he didn't move. Then I thought about going into supper. It was well past the time I should have finished in any case. Lots of bad sinners had needed sorting out that night. I thought perhaps he didn't want to take confession at all. Perhaps he'd just come in to pray. There was a little gap between the door and the frame through which I could see a sliver of the church. I looked through it and saw the man was leaning forward in the pew, hunched over, but not kneeling, his eyes fixed, staring at the box as if willing himself to move towards it. The light directly above fell on him, pooling round him, making him clearly visible to me. Quite an ordinary-looking sort of chap, really, early 30s, smartly dressed, but no tie, working class, probably. Then I noticed his hands. They were caked with blood. I saw his clothes were stained with blood, too, badly stained. I sat back, a little frightened. Not too unusual to see a bit of blood on Saturday night, fights in the pubs and what have you, but so much. I heard him cross the marble of the aisle. Then he had a little trouble opening the door. The catch sometimes sticks, but finally he managed it. There was a pause as his eyes adjusted to the gloom, and then he knelt down, and after another slightly longer pause he spoke. His first few words gave me pause for thought. 17 years since I've been to confession, Father. 17 years. I desperately tried to think of what we were having for supper that night. Then I realized it was all right. Just a cold collation of the leftovers from the food stall in the parish bazaar that afternoon. And so he got underway, and I, having given a little wiggle on my cushion to get it just right, settled down for a long 17-year listen, not knowing that the confession I was to hear and the conclusions I reached afterwards were going to change my life and my belief forever. He'd led a normal enough life, working-class secondary school boy, Catholic, of course, Merseyside by the sound of it, Liverpool or Wallasey, perhaps. He was a pre-Vatican II Catholic, so he knew what it was like to have the fear of God instilled in you from birth. There was nothing very special about this man's childhood sinning, though he did seem very fussed about it, I must admit. And even though he had a good turn of phrase, at one point he talked of wheeling a soot ball of mortal sin up to the altar in front of him every Sunday as he went to take communion, and of expecting to be struck by lightning as the host touched his tongue. I'd soon had enough of it. And suddenly he was almost crying, talking about a butterfly he'd killed, a beautiful blue butterfly. Got angry because the priest wouldn't give him a penance for killing it. The priest said it's only an insect and doesn't count unless you enjoy it, which of course was true. It's no sin to kill an insect unless you're a Buddhist, and he obviously wasn't a Buddhist, as that would have been a contradiction in terms. You can't be a Catholic Buddhist now, can you? His story of the beautiful blue butterfly affected him deeply, but it didn't touch me. I thought, get on with it, man, supper's waiting. He'd had a drink or two. I could smell it on his breath as it wafted through the gauze. And you can't trust emotion where there's drink involved. Too easy to be maudlin then, as I know to my cost. I started to practice a welcome home to Jesus speech for when he'd finally got it all off his chest, at the rate he was going, somewhere around midnight, probably. I didn't know, of course, at that time what he had done. Didn't know that the blood on his hands was fresh, that the body of the victim was still warm. I didn't know that only two streets away, the ambulance and the police were gathered to view a blood-stained corpse. Didn't know at this very moment the town was being sealed off to stop his escape. And he was evading it, talking about everything and anything to avoid saying what had finally dragged him back to Mother Church. By now, I knew why he'd left. His father, after a lifetime of not going to church, called for a priest on his deathbed. As the penitent put it, He sold his soul to God, and the price was his self-respect. The man had seen that as a cowardly act and had left the church in protest. Now, after 17 years, he was coming back. Why? Tell me why, and be done with it, so I can go in and have my supper. Come on, man, tell me and get it off your chest. And finally he did. He was passing through town, met some people in the pub who invited him to a party. He had nothing better to do, so went along with them. It was a good evening, lots of laughs, lots of good crack. He went in the kitchen where some food was laid out. He was the first in, picked up a beef sandwich. A man came in he hadn't seen before, and a bit embarrassed that he'd been found alone in the kitchen eating, he made a little joke about it, a Catholic joke. A joke referring to the long-gone days when you could only eat fish on a Friday. Good job it's not Friday, he said. I couldn't be eating this if it was Friday. Beef. And the stranger crossed the room to stand in front of him, his face only inches away, eyes full of hate. He said, "Are you a Catholic?" He spat the word in the penitent's face full of venom. "Are you a Catholic?" he repeated. The penitent hadn't been inside a church for 17 years. But he couldn't help himself but say it in the face of the man's obvious repugnance to it. "Yes, I'm a Catholic." And then the vituperation started, a torrent of anti-Catholic vituperation which finally drove a failed Catholic to commit the ultimate sin. The man tongue-lashed the penitent, accusing him of every evil the Catholic Church has ever been guilty of, from the Inquisition to the present day, calling him a Catholic butcher, shouting he'd put bombs in prams with babies in Belfast, and many worse things, much worse things. He used the C word, Catholic C. "You're a Catholic C." And once he saw how repugnant the penitent found that filthy word, he said it over and over again. Dag, dag, dag into his mind, a constant goading chant. I realized as the words poured out of the penitent's mouth that I, too, felt the bile rising. What he was saying was too much to be borne. How dare anyone speak like that to a Catholic, failed or otherwise? And then the penitent went on to describe how he had found himself searching with his hand behind his back for something with which to stop this blasphemy. I was pleased and prayed he would find something. And he did. He found a breadboard and the handle of a bread knife nested in the board. I was exultant for him. "Take it out. Take it out," I heard myself shouting inside my head. "Take it out. Make him stop saying these obscenities." He brought the knife to the front and pushed it in the man's belly, pushed it up to the hilt into his belly. It was the right thing to do. It was the only thing to do. And I was full of joy because the man's mouth stopped moving. His filthy, twisted teeth stopped chewing on the anti-Catholic cant he'd been spouting too long. The last C word died on his lips. A look of surprise in his eyes, he finally slid off the knife to the kitchen floor, and I could see him so clearly in my mind's eye, as if I'd been there and done the deed myself. I realized I was crying. Tears were streaming from my eyes. The penitent was crying too. Somehow I got control, wiped my eyes, tried to still my racing pulse and pull myself together. In a case like that, there is only one answer. We learn it, but never anticipate having to use it. I had to let him know there was no penance, no absolution available to him until he gave himself up, went to the police. If required, I would go with him. I told him so. He was more than angry. He was furious. "No absolution? What do you mean, no absolution?" He screamed at me, his face pressed up to the gauze, inches away from me, taking on a nightmare quality. But then, after berating me in a like manner for a while, a sort of quiet calm came over him. He sat back on his heels, and his voice became a velvet whisper through the gauze. "Don't you see, Father? I have nothing to confess. I didn't kill anyone. I didn't kill anyone. You killed him, Father. You, Mother Church. You taught me how special I am. You taught me to defend the faith. You taught me to be prepared to die for my faith, and if need be, to kill for my faith. I didn't kill anyone, Father. You killed him. You killed him. But don't worry, Father, he wasn't a Catholic. He was just an insect. And insects don't count, do they? Unless you enjoy it. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen." Then he slowly stood, left the box, and walked up the aisle until his footsteps disappeared, and I heard the front door of the church slam shut behind him. I continued to sit in the confessional, dazed and drained, and of course, I realized he was right. I was with him as he faced up to that bigot every step of the way. For once in my life, I had had the courage to face up to a bully. I had felt the heat of my own passion burning out of control for long enough to have done the deed myself. A secret button had been pushed deep inside my being. A button that had triggered a lethal hidden weapon that had been growing there throughout my entire Catholic life. I, too, could have found it in my heart to defend the faith by killing that less-than-human creature that would have destroyed it. I was as guilty as the murderer. I didn't kill him, but I could have done. I could have done. A button had been pushed. I never enjoyed confession after that. That is the moment my hatred of the sacrament truly started. He was never caught, slipped through the net somehow, and I can't hear footsteps walking up the side aisle without wondering if it is him coming back to remove me, to destroy the evidence I carry in my brain by destroying me, evidence that could, of course, never be disclosed, inviolable. But perhaps he doesn't know that. And finally, after that evening, the terrible truth hit home and stays with me to this day. I don't believe anymore. The host touching my tongue no longer fills me with a golden glow. A light has gone out in my soul. So, why do I stay? There's nowhere for me to go. I'm one of God's priestly derelicts. This confessional is my street corner. The only thing missing is I don't sell the big issue in here. God's derelicts? So, do I believe in God? Yes. That's all that's left. Forget the trappings, forget the church, forget the priesthood, forget it all. It's man-made, it's Hans Christian Andersen. It's Jesus and the King's new clothes. It is pure papal bull. I forget it all, and then all that I'm left with after a lifetime of caring and giving is a handful of words. Seeds to save my soul. I believe in God. I believe in the Virgin Mary sitting full of grace at his side. I believe in his Son, Jesus Christ, who was born to save us. What a pity he missed out on me. I could have done with being saved. I could do with being saved. Too late. Much too late. Still, better get on. There's work to be done. Saturday night. I hate Saturday night. Worst night of the week.